Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the battlefront of major combat operations in Iraq, they brought us stories of heat and dust and death. Now they're applying what they saw to the challenges of guerrilla war and reconstruction. On Point invited three A-list reporters recently returned from Iraq to gather on a summer day thousands of miles from the front. We invited them to sit back, shake off the dust, and share their memories and their lessons learned on 21st century war coverage and America in Iraq. Tonight, in a special edition of On Point, What I Learned in Iraq, recorded live on Martha's Vineyard at the Old Wailing Church in Edgartown, Massachusetts.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. We have 1 hour tonight. I want to try and squeeze every drop of juice out of this hour. We've got great people with us, Raghi Omar, John Burnett, and Michael Goldfarb. But it's summertime, and I want to take you back just to set the frame with a timetable. March 20th. Bombs over Baghdad, and within hours, U.S. troops rolling in from the south. April 9th, Baghdad falls. May 1st, President Bush on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln. Mid-July, guerrilla war. We are going to do much more than remember tonight, but for a moment, let's go back.
Our correspondent, Raghi Omar, is in central Baghdad, and he's watching the statue coming down as I speak. Let's hear what he's saying.
And ever more so day by day, minute by minute, his grip on this whole country that he has ruled for 25 years. They're urging them to pull the statue down. And there it goes. It's chanting death to Saddam. And it was captured in front of ordinary Iraqis, American Marines, and the whole of the world's media.
NPR's John Burnett is traveling with units of the 1st Marine Division.
What they're telling me is that they're not encountering the large organized resistance, company size, battalion size, that an army expects to fight against another army. But what they're finding are, again, more of these paramilitary, very, very committed fighters, irregulars in civilian clothes.
They want to fight, but are still waiting for the word from U.S. commanders before engaging the Iraqis. For now, a bloodless advance through Iraqi territory and clearing up the explosive mess Saddam's soldiers left behind is all the combat they're getting. For WBUR, I'm Michael Goldfarb reporting.
So here we are tonight. So many questions, emotions, here on beautiful Martha's Vineyard, around the country, really across the world, in the minds of everybody sitting here tonight, in the minds of Iraqis, in the minds of young American soldiers in Nasiriyah and Mosul and Fallujah and Baghdad tonight. Life is full of surprises, whether we should be surprised or not. I'm guessing that when this night was organized, the expectation was, through no one's fault, we were all kind of in the groove, right along the line of the White House script. And it would have been nice, in a way. War over. President on the wall in his victory jumpsuit. Iraq diving into reconstruction. Now, oh, how much more complicated the world is than that. How much more complex. And this disturbing complexity of where we find ourselves now, tonight, casts a very different light on the recent rush of major combat operations themselves. Perhaps it was not a decisive thunderclap, but a massive starting gun that we saw. And so we want to hear with new ears what each of these correspondents saw, heard, and learned in Iraq. I'm very honored to share the stage with the three journalists that we have with us tonight, and I'm so glad to all of you for being here and appreciate your support. I want to introduce them. First, Southwestern correspondent for National Public Radio has been for many years, John Burnett. Raghi Omar was most recently the BBC's Africa correspondent based in Johannesburg. Most significantly for us here tonight, for the last 6 or 7 years, Raghi Omar has been in and out of Iraq constantly. This was not new terrain for Raghi Omar as the war came on. He spent the war in Baghdad. He was among the journalists who ended up in the Palestine Hotel where the final conclave was. You all have a sense of what that was about. We're very honored that he's with us here tonight, Raghi Omar. And finally, a man who I'm so proud to call my colleague at WBUR, Michael Goldfarb. Michael, many of you will know from the local airwaves, and of course many listeners across the country will as well. He's made his home in London for the better part of the last 20 years. He was for years NPR's correspondent there. 48 hours before the war began, Michael came into the north of Iraq, into Kurdistan, set up base there. Michael dug in and found an intensely human story that he told in a great documentary for the WBUR's documentary unit, Inside Out. He brought the story of the war home to us in a very, very personal way. Neither an embed, as John was, nor in Baghdad, as Raghi was, but a kind of unilateral, a free floating agent in the north of Iraq. I was very honored to be able to interview him, and it was most informative throughout the war to do that. We're so delighted he's with us tonight, Michael Goldfarb. I want to jump in this way, if I may, with my colleagues. Each of you spent a substantial amount of time covering this war. So much has happened since what we thought was the decisive thunderclap. We now have this description of guerrilla war. You were there. We heard you on the radio. We heard the intensity of the situations you were in. We heard the courage that you showed in your reports. We heard occasionally the fear. Here you are, all a few weeks out of Iraq now, seeing what you saw, hearing what you're now hearing. John Burnett, let me go first to you. What thoughts brim to the top of your mind as you look and listen and watch what we're all seeing out of your experience in Iraq? Now you're looking at the present situation. What does it bring to mind?
The immediacy of traveling with the 1st Marine Division for those remarkable 3 weeks as it moved from Kuwait up into Baghdad. It was the story that was electrifying the world at the moment. NPR went 24/7 with it. Most of the TV networks did. We trained for this. There were 500-plus embedded reporters, the largest number of reporters that had ever been invited to cover a military action before. There was training. There was chemical weapons awareness. Tremendous buildup, not just for the troops, but for the reporters themselves. And then there was the war unfolded during those 3 weeks. And it was an astonishing story. And it seems so dated now. It seems like it was almost in another era. I'm married to a historian, and so while I live in the moment, you know, the rough draft, she actually gets to write the history. And so she keeps reminding me about what historians are going to care about. And what they're going to write about, largely, I think, is what's happening right now. Not so much the combat and the battles, the outcome of which we knew that U.S. was going to be successful. It was just a question of how much and whether it'd be chemical weapons. But I really think the story now is the one that is even more gripping. We're not getting 24/7 coverage. We're not having stand-ups in front of, fewer in front of Abrams tanks, and all of the dramatic coverage that was going on. But in a sense, I think the story now is really more important for America's standing in the world, for the future of Iraq. And so I would say I know you all wouldn't be here unless you were staying tuned, but stay tuned.
Stay tuned. There was a lot of drama then, but the story is very much now. And interestingly, unlike Afghanistan, where U.S. troops are down to a very low level now, unlike other places where the U.S. has come in and then left, this is a very hard country to walk away from. It's so strategically located. It sits on top of all this oil. It's hard to imagine how the U.S. is going to pull out, when it's going to pull out. Raghi Omar, same question to you. Top of mind now as you look back on your experience then and the reality now.
I suppose it leaves me with week by week, but I suppose overall the feeling I have is one of mild foreboding, if I can put it that way. I mean, as you said, that I'd been in and out of Iraq for close to 7 years before the war actually began, and had the opportunity to observe not just what Saddam had done to Iraq and Iraqis, but also the apparatus of fear and rule that he'd built up over a quarter of a century. And I think being in Baghdad throughout the war, there were two clear impressions that one was left with. One, journalists often sort of labor the point in saying that, you know, the we have the opportunity of having a front row seat in history, of seeing historic events. But literally, I mean, the 100 or so journalists that remained in Baghdad, night after night, we would look out from our hotel room on the banks of the Tigris to the other side of the river where the heart of monumental Iraq, the government ministries, the presidential compounds, the security headquarters where Saddam had ruled, literally just went up in huge balls of fire and masonry spread all over the place. But whilst the war was this thunderclap and incredibly successful in a really quite a relatively short space of time, I think that looking at the TV images coming out of Baghdad and Nasiriyah and other places today, and what US soldiers and British soldiers in Basra are facing, is that I hope we haven't underestimated just how sophisticated and complex the system that Saddam built was. It is something that served him and allowed him to resist numerous attempts to overthrow him from within Iraq and from outside as well. And this is also a reason why, clearly, even the British and American governments believe he is still alive, and so are a lot of the senior officials in the 55, the deck of cards. I think that's basically what we're seeing now. What's something that I was quite clear on, and anyone else who'd gone to Iraq, that as one of my Kurdish friends who I worked with in Baghdad said the day I was leaving, and I said, you know, it's really over, and he just said, Raggy, it's going to take a long time, and I think he's right.
The thunderclap behind us, but that network, that system you described, still organically entrenched, perhaps. And Michael Goldfarb, you observed from the north, you really got in under the skin of many Iraqis, but one in particular followed him as he went through his emotional arc of watching the war and its aftermath. Your thoughts now, looking back, knowing what we know today.
Well, Tom, if you had told me when we drove into Mosul, which is the big population center in northern Iraq, a million people, that the situation wouldn't have improved or would deteriorate, as it seems to be doing 90 days after the end of the war, I wouldn't have believed it, because it seemed to me that so much politically was at stake for this administration and of course, for the British government, that failure was not an option. But it's clear that no one had really thought through what the reality on the ground was. Now, Raghi was talking about, you know, the networks that Saddam has built. I mean, the thing to understand is that before the war, the notion was that victory would bring forth something like VE Day, and there'd be rose petals thrown in front of the troops and a great coupling of American soldiers and Iraqi maidens, and everyone would be happy. And in fact...
Or maybe not.
But the truth is that when you overthrow a totalitarian regime, and believe me, this is a totalitarian regime, you have to scour out people's minds, hearts, and souls, because 35 years of the Ba'ath Party, 25 years of Saddam, and you don't know anything from the moment you get up to the moment you go to sleep. Who you're talking to is not reporting you back to the secret police. Everything that happens in your life is shaped by the regime. Now the regime is gone, and people still in their souls, I believe, don't know what will happen next. And there is nothing strong enough put forward by the American government, the British government, to bring people along. And so it's in a very loose and liquid state, I think. I mean, I hear from Ahmed from time to time. He's managed to save enough money working for me in the Los Angeles Times to buy a Thuraya. So sometimes he gets through to Britain.
The satellite phone.
Thuraya is the small satellite phone. It's no bigger than a cell phone. And it's everybody's lifeline there to the outside world, because the phones don't work at the moment. And he goes up and down, as he went up and down the day that Mosul fell. I mean, yes, it's great because Saddam is gone, and then there's this terrible, terrible despair because there's no economy. He can't feed his family. People aren't sure, because the way it works is, you know, three people on your street worked for the Ba'ath Party. They still live on your street. Saddam is still alive. How free can you be with your new freedom and be absolutely certain that something you say today won't land you in a torture chamber in 6 months?
We're listening to a special live edition of On Point from the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.
Ashbrook, this is a special edition of On Point from the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. We're talking with three reporters recently returned from Iraq about their memories and lessons learned on 21st century war coverage and America in Iraq.
The war was tremendously consequential in its own framework. A regime was pushed out of Baghdad and pushed out in a remarkably short period of time. I wish, just to give us a sense of that dramatic period, that I wonder if I could ask each of you to share with us the vivid moment, that kind of one of those memories that you might share one day with grandchildren. John Burnett?
When we hear about weapons of mass destruction and chemical and biological weapons now, it's almost in the context of late-night comedians. We're cynical, we're skeptical, and I can't emphasize how real the sense was that they would be used on U.S. troops. And the moment that really comes to mind was early one morning, about 2 a.m., when the artillery battalion that I was traveling with arrived on the outskirts of Baghdad. And we had been told that this was when the Republican Guard was most likely to use chemical weapons, when they were fighting for their lives. They were backed into a corner. They're the ones who had the authorization to use this. And so we had moved to a higher level of chemical protectiveness. We were in the boots and always had our gas mask on our hips. And so we arrived at this position. All of the big trucks and the howitzers were being pulled into place, and the gas alert went off. And so someone yelled, "Gas, gas, gas," which is what we'd been hearing for a couple of weeks by that time. But there was no all clear sign. And someone said, "This is for real." And so we started pulling on the gloves, and we were already wearing most of the suits. And then the mask went on. You have to understand that the kind of training that we had gone through had scared the living daylights out of everyone, reporters and Marines alike. There was a lot of bravado that you probably heard from some of the senior officers, but when you got down to the grunt level, there was a lot of fear of this, because we were even told that there was a drug that would be used for the transition. If you were on the ground doing the floppy chicken, if you had been slimed, as the Marines say, they would help your transition. They would help, put you to sleep, basically. This was not a way that anybody wanted to die.
To die peacefully, that is.
That's right.
Wow.
And so what happened was, so we all sat there in the darkness with our chemical gear on, and it was very quiet. It was extremely quiet, and everyone was having their own thoughts. And just kind of wondering, and we learned that chemical weapons could smell either like fresh-cut grass or like almonds, and so we were kind of sniffing the air within the gas mask trying to see if one of those was evident. And then we were in the northern part of the Fertile Crescent, so there was a lot of marshes around, and all of a sudden I started hearing all these frogs that were calling for wild amphibious sex, as they do in the marshes around the world. And the frogs were calling, and the frogs were okay. And I figured, these were the ultimate canaries in the coal mine. If there's anything in an atmosphere, a frog is going to soak it up into its skin, and it's going to be the first to die. And so I realized that we're going to be okay, the frogs. I told this to Michelle Norris on All Things Considered one night, this whole story. And sure enough, about 5 minutes later, the all-clear sign came, and it turned out it was a diesel truck exhaust, which had set off the the sophisticated gas detector. And that was the last alert that we had, because at that point, as you all well know, the forces overwhelmed Baghdad. There was everyone pretty much stopped wearing the chemical gear at that point.
But God bless those frogs. Oh,
God bless the frogs, yes. Whenever I hear night frogs now, I'm going to think they're telling me I'm going to live.
Tell us one more. I read, John has a story in the Columbia Journalism Review just this last month about the process of embedding with the troops, and we'll talk about that. But you mentioned a story there of a lieutenant, if I've got it right, Rodriguez, mm-hmm. who your Humvee had come under fire, and he leapt out with the Marines and charged the open window that the sniper fire was coming from with just a 9mm pistol. Yeah. Lucky for you, brave of him.
He was... Before I go any farther, I also want to acknowledge two people in the audience whose son I was able to interview, Lance Corporal Alex Arredondo, who was with an Amtrak crew, one of the first ones to cross the Diyala River into Baghdad. Carlos and Melida Arredondo are sitting right here. They came all the way from Boston to say hi. Y'all stand up. Their son, when I met him, 18 years old.
Yeah, here he is.
And he was in the Iraqi National Tobacco Factory, which they were occupying at the time, with all of the nasty cigarettes they would ever want to smoke. But he's still over there.
Our love and wish him well. Thanks for being here.
Anyway, to make a long story short, we came under fire one day in Baghdad. I was with this infantry unit. It was in that moment that I really understood vividly, first person, how incredibly aggressive the Marines are, how well-trained they are, and how they just race into the fight. There was some Fedayeen that started firing assault weapons at us, Kalashnikovs, from a second-story window. They stopped the Humvee, and Lieutenant Oscar Rodriguez, with his 9mm, led his troops, his men, into the fight, them with their M16s blazing, and just incredible valor, really. And, of course, my first reaction was what everyone's reaction, especially reporters, which was to, be as still and get out of the fighting. And it was the machine gunner on top of the Humvee that threw an M16 in my lap, knowing I was where I was from. And he said, "You're from Texas. Use that thing."
In slightly different words, John tells us.
Yeah, yeah. The FCC wouldn't let us use the whole quote.
Thank you, John. Raghi, your kids are at home tonight. One day, maybe grandkids. What story do you think you'll tell? What will stick with you? What's most vivid in your mind?
I'm not sure how much I'd want to tell them about the experience of being in Baghdad, but I suppose there were three periods of remaining in Baghdad, and the first was the approach of war. I'd been going to Baghdad with a lot of other journalists from America, Britain, Europe, the rest of the Middle East for a year, really following on from President Bush's State of the Union address, which seemed pretty clear that was certainly the initial sort of countdown for some kind of confrontational war. And despite that, I don't think anybody in Baghdad, including foreign reporters or the people of Baghdad themselves, really fully grasped what was coming. And I think the realization for everybody there came when the United States and Britain issued the 48-hour deadline for Saddam and his two sons to leave. And I remember very distinctly going down to Sharjah Market in eastern Baghdad, which is a very large open market where ordinary people would go to shop. You find pulses and oils and just basic produce. And I just remember this scene of pandemonium. And that's when my personal sort of realization that war was only hours away came. And you just saw
They had gone from that famously kind of placid anticipation of war to the chemistry of war breaking loose in them.
You just saw this frantic sort of, rush for masking tape to sellotape up the windows, candles, all the basic little essentials of life. And that's the most sort of pathetic thing, I think, in the proper sense of the word, when you see ordinary, and decent Iraqis, who are not members of the party, just, young fathers, mothers, grandparents.
Many of whom had seen American bombardment before.
Yeah,
in the first
Gulf War. Exactly. And of course, it just raised an enormous amount of self-examination amongst those foreigners who were there, be they journalists or diplomats or otherwise, about what to do, whether one was going to stay or not. And I think the press corps went down from around 800, certainly when just when the deadline was issued, to the start of hostilities. And I suppose the first night, immediately after the deadline began. And I'd heard the air raid sirens in Baghdad before, but there was something almost sort of, plaintive and something that just made you feel sick and certainly very cold when you heard the first air raid sirens, resounding across this empty city. There was literally sort of tumbleweed blowing through it. Everyone had raced home. And I suppose the nightly bombardments, initially in the first nights, the smallest sort of explosions coming from some way off would just make you jump out of your skin. But inevitably, as is the case, and it's nothing to do with bravery or foolhardiness, it is part of the human condition that you get used to living in such circumstances. And, even the very heavy bombardments that went into the day that weren't just in the night, you find yourself sleeping through them, which is incredibly worrying. And there were certain days when the bombardment was very heavy, and the Palestine hotel is about 16, 17 stories high. and some of the penetration bombs that were used on the main telecommunications center, which is about a mile from the hotel, a mile and a half maybe. And the whole building just swayed gently, sort of, you know, side to side in a sort of S shape. But and of course the statue coming down. But the thing,
the Saddam statue coming down, the famous footage.
But the thing,
well, many of us wondered about that.
Yeah.
Whether it was a made for TV event that was only meaningful in the small square of a CNN viewfinder, or if it felt meaningful on the scene.
Felt,
you were there in that plaza.
No, it was iconic. I mean, look, of course, you know, that statue was toppled because the whole of the world's TV cameras were rolling from the roof of the Palestine Hotel. And that's why the Marines came there and did it. It was to sort of show that the war in Baghdad was essentially over. But from that morning, when Mujahideen had arrived in the hotel, and everyone thought that it was to, you know, kill the last amount of sort of journalists who were there, but actually it was a rather pathetic sort of sight because they were just, you know, away from their countries. They'd run out of money. They were terrified. The Marines were just a kilometer down the road, and they didn't know what was going to happen to them. So they came to the hotel thinking that the journalists there would make them feel safe. But this was going on all across Baghdad, you know, in public building after public building, statues were being defaced. That was the iconic moment that summed up what was happening throughout the city that day. But I want to say that I know everybody concentrates on the actual statue coming down. And, I mean, I was at the foot of it, and it was quite amazing. But the thing that was hit me in the gut much more was when the stars and stripes were put on the statue's face.
Yes.
And that you just heard, you could almost hear the gasps, you know, throughout the Middle East at that stage.
And what did they mean?
Well, what it meant was it was the most honest encapsulation of what had happened, which is that, you know, American will, I mean, military and political will had brought Saddam Hussein down. By sheer will, this war had ripped the edifice of the Saddam government down. And that's something that people feel very strongly about in many different ways all over the world. And I think, to me, that was the most breathtaking and truly honest moment of that day. But what happened afterwards, the first days of the rule, were, I felt, I mean, both most terrified about, which was just the army of looters that
chaos.
The utter chaos. And I know that Marines felt ashamed about it initially, because I talked to some of them, and I was standing 400 yards from the Iraqi Central Bank, which was being systematically looted. Mm. There were young kids going in with sledgehammers, and I was speaking to a Marine, and he said, look, this is shameful. You know, this shouldn't be going on, but frankly, there aren't enough numbers here at the moment, and we still have to worry about remnants of the Fedayeen. The looters are not a problem. But what I couldn't understand was, fine, you know, people are going to loot, they're going to take tables and things like that, but
yes.
Why burn the ministries? You know, why loot the hospital? And there was a nihilism about it that no one was stopping, and that's what I couldn't understand. And that's what began the affair between American soldiers and Baghdadis, got it off to a bad start.
And the case made that despite all the effort at pinpoint bombing, the destruction followed anyway. Michael Goldfarb, the moments that will resonate for you.
Well, actually, Rocky's already touched on two of them. One was Raghi had the enviable and unenviable task of describing Saddam's statue being toppled for the BBC. And in my hotel room in northern Iraq and Kurdistan, we had the Beeb through satellite TV, and it went on and on and on for an hour and a half. And
took a long time to fall.
And he did the business. He kept going long after he'd run. No human being could have that many adjectives to sustain, you know, for 90 minutes.
Going.
And it was quite extraordinary. And I was sitting there with my tape recorder because I knew that as soon as that statue was finally toppled, there'd be insanity in the streets of Erbil, because the Kurds, you know, who Saddam was particularly brutal towards, would come out, and I couldn't miss the start of the friendly riot, and it finally had happened, and I got the sound of the friendly riot, and that was all cool. And about a week later, when Mosul fell, and it didn't fall in the sense that there was a fight for it, the regime melted away, and a precious few American soldiers and Kurdish Peshmerga went into the town, I took my friend Ahmad Shokat back. He and his oldest son, who's 26, been living in exile in Erbil. It's a distance of 60 miles. It could have been, 6,000 miles. They simply couldn't go back. It was their lives if they did. And they went back, and the level of excitement and happiness and joy in the car as we raced towards this place, and I had my tape recorder running the whole time. We get to Mosul, and the looting was indescribable. And I say indescribable because it wasn't looting like, you know, the great blackout of New York City of 1977, which I lived through. Now, that was a different kind of looting. This was everything. Every single thing, and it goes back to the regime. If your name was on a piece of paper, people were running into buildings. They wanted to see their names. The streets, I mean, it was like a snowstorm of paper. Schools, hospitals, everything. Turning over all of the records, burning them, setting them on fire. There's plenty of food in Iraq, but there's no money to buy it. The UN food stores had been completely looted. And, you know, people of all sizes and ages staggering away with bags of rice, bags of beans. The central bank was being looted, and there was no one to stop it. And so we were watching this constantly. There was violence everywhere. And I've been in a few riots, and I have never been in a place. When you cover a riot, I mean, just for safety's sake, you put your tape recorder on, and you see where safety is. Usually it's a line of police down an alleyway. And, you know, you can go this far into the riot to get your sound, and if it gets heavy, you can duck behind the cops. There's no cops. There's nothing. And anywhere you looked, at any time, at any moment, someone could take a pot shot. They were taking pot shots. A colleague got knifed. The L.A. Times correspondent there got knifed. That was extraordinary, but what was more extraordinary was at the end of the first day, committees went out from all the mosques with loudspeakers, saying, bring your looted goods back to the mosque. And the next day we went back to Mosul, and by God, they brought all the stuff they'd looted back to the mosque. They had been successfully shamed by the imams and their neighbors to bring stuff back to the mosques. And I went to a mosque just across from Mosul University, and upstairs in an office, there was a little clinic going on because they'd looted the hospital, and they'd been shamed, and they brought all the medicine and, you know, surgical material back to the mosque. And there were three doctors, and they were conducting a clinic for people who had to get, you know, an injection every day. And that, to me, was probably the most extraordinary thing I saw in the entire time I was there. And I think about it often when I look at Iraq as it is today, kind of in this in-between, quite violent around Baghdad state, and I realize that there isn't general anarchy in the north. There isn't general anarchy in the Shiite areas of the south. Because there is, within the society, I think a very strong desire to have some sense of order. And there is an organization of civil society. It's called the mosque. And it is functioning. And that's about all that's functioning.
And we have to hope that that fabric pulls together and sort of joins naturally in with the efforts of others to pull this country together.
We're listening to a special live edition of On Point from the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support Ashbrook. This is a special edition of On Point from the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. We're talking tonight with NPR correspondent John Burnett, the BBC's Raghi Omar, and WBUR special correspondent Michael Goldfarb.
I just want to very quickly acknowledge each of these three guys who went through this circumstance, left wives at home. Two of them are with us this weekend. But I don't think it's too much to ask for a little hand for the women who had to sit at home and wonder what was happening. And I will also point out that there were husbands who sat at home waiting on wives and female journalists. Our time ticks. I want to ask John Burnett, you wrote recently about the process of embedding. We have a very interesting array here tonight. Michael, who was not attached to the military, Raghi, who was on his own in Baghdad, and John, who was fully embedded in the system that was rolled out. You wrote about it for the CGR, the Columbia Journalism Review, and you were pretty tough on it there.
I sort of diverge from probably most of the reporters who were embedded, because I am a bit critical of it. Not a little bit, fairly critical of it. I think the system did work because compared to the coverage of the Gulf War 12 years ago, which was an abysmal system of pools where it was just kind of a snake pit of friends and connections and who was going to be in the all-desirable pool to go out and cover the combat of that day. And so as a reaction to the pool system of the first Gulf War, they came up with embedding.
Leave it to the Pentagon to come up with a name like embedding. It's what did Walter Cronkite say? It rhymes with in bed with. And I'm not sure if we ever really shook that image. It was wonderful in that we did have front row seats to this extremely important and dynamic military action. And when some journalists asked in Kuwait before everyone left, Colonel, how close can we get? He said, as close as you want to. And that absolutely was the truth. And the journalists who died covering the war attest to that. The problem I have with embedding is that we were attached to the units forevermore for the duration of the action. And we could not leave those units. We could not leave to go into a village or a town to explore what were behind the faces that were waving at the troops as they came through, those who did wave. As a terrific journalist named George Wilson, who covered Vietnam, one of the few embedded reporters who was there, as he told me, as we were lying in camp one day waiting for a Humvee to get closer to the front, he said, when the shells go downrange, we're told that they've hit their targets, but we're never able to go find out for ourselves. We have to take the colonel's word for this. And what I wrote is that in some sense, I felt like a captive cheerleader, which is not to say that I didn't tremendously admire the valor and the professionalism of the men and women I was covering, but I felt that it was an unnatural way to practice journalism for me. I felt imbalanced. I felt that I wasn't able to get another version of this. Now, my editors say, calm down, John. It was better than you think. At NPR, we talked to unilaterals. We talked to generals who retired generals. We talked to Steve Inskeep in Doha. And so we were able to get a larger sense of the battlefield. But I never could shake the feeling that we weren't getting the entire story. And it came back to me just how much we missed when I left Baghdad and got a car and driver and planned to go back down the route that the 1st Marine Division had gone on, literally just by happenstance, stopped in a little village and stopped in the hospital, and they said, oh, there was a terrible accident here, a bombing, and a bunch of civilians were killed. And I went to investigate and found out that one night, 21 men, women, and children were killed in their beds in Altania village, Iraqi civilians, because a precision-guided weapon had gone awry that was dropped from an F-16 Strike Eagle, which was aiming at tanks and tracked vehicles on Route 7. They clearly missed their target, and when I asked the military for an explanation, they said, we have no explanation, that the after-mission reports say that all the targets were hit, and so, you know, we really don't have anything to tell you other than this doesn't reflect what we've learned about the mission. That may or may not be an extreme anomaly for this war, but those were the kinds of things that, you know, you couldn't find out when you were embedded and did happen. So it told me a lot.
It is a rare opportunity to have this kind of firsthand observation right here among us. And let me put it very quickly to each of you. Was there awareness among the American troops and officers of what they were getting into here? The diversity of Iraq, its long and deep history, the kind of fragmented cultural scene there. Michael.
Well, I think that's the question that Donald Rumsfeld refers to his political masters. The guys that I spoke to when I was there, the war was going on, and they were totally focused on military questions. One, there were very few American soldiers in the North. I spent time with special forces simply because they were out there, and because they are older. Green Beret, by the time you get to be a Green Beret, you're an adult. And so they're much more willing to talk. But that kind of political question was simply not on the cards. And as for the young men of the 173rd Parachute Regiment who flew in, they were there, but they never were going to see big combat. They were very young, and they were there inside the military. They answered questions and referred most further along and to a higher pay grade. So we never had that conversation.
Mm. John Burnett and Rocky, let me put it very quickly to each of you. Your impression, there are 150,000 troops there now with a great big job to do that's not war making but something else. Your impression of their readiness for that, is this what they were trained for? Do they have the capacity? And here they've got this diversity to deal with.
I attempted to have a lot of political discussions with the Marines that I traveled with and didn't get very far with a lot because, I mean, many saluted smartly and charged up the hill. They agreed with the mission. The only people who I met who didn't agree were a couple of chaplains and a couple of Navy surgeons, and most weren't political at all. The route home was through Baghdad, and they missed home, and they missed their sweethearts. And as far as being prepared for it, virtually every fighting man that was in this war said, you know, our job is to go and break down the door. It's not to guard the house. And they felt very ill at ease acting as police. And they would say the reason why we didn't stop the looting is because we weren't trained to do this. We weren't trained to guard buildings.
And, Raghi, you saw the troops flowing into Baghdad with some trepidation yourself, wondering how they would greet you as a journalist and the others. But the chemistry that you saw there, what does it portend?
I think the first thing to say is, I mean, in terms of the Marines that I met that John was also traveling with, I mean, I was very interesting. They came to our office at the Palestine Hotel, a lot of these young Marines, to use our satellite phones to call their families back in America. So literally, we just had huge lines of Marines outside our office, you know, wanting to use the phone. But I was doing lives from Baghdad, and having been there and being asked exactly the same question. And I was, having been in Baghdad, pretty much giving a skeptical view of how much certainly the political authorities, I can't speak for the United States because I haven't spoken to enough senior officials, but I can speak about British officials, what little honesty there has been, to be honest with you, about realizing how much they knew about internal Iraqi political and economic forces and officials.
You mean they knew a great deal or they knew little?
They knew very little. And I think, I mean, for the British, who have always prided themselves in perhaps being much more au fait in terms of the Middle East, having a much longer imperial history and involvement going back many years and many generations of Foreign Office diplomats, the one thing that one has to realize is that for 12 years prior to this war, not one British diplomat or intelligence officer or American had set foot in Iraq. If you were to go, as I did, back to London and speak to senior policy people within the Foreign Office on the Iraq desk, can you name who is ex-permanent secretary in the foreign ministry? Or who they just simply do not know. And I think that's why the transitional process now is so vital. The learning curve is very steep. I think there is perhaps the impression that it was all figured out, you know, the war would happen, reconstruction would just take off, all the officials who worked in all the ministries would just simply come back and work happily with the new transitional agreement. That isn't happening. And I give you one example. One of the officials, a lowly minder, who I knew for a very long time, who gave us all the information. I mean, he was supposed to mind us, but in fact he told us when the hotel was going to be raided for satellite phones. He was terrified of what would happen to him once British and American forces captured Baghdad. He was utterly terrified. And I said, Ayad, don't worry. You know, as soon as this happens, you will be, you know, a BBC employee. We wrote him out letters in Arabic and English. Show this to the first American soldier. And besides, they're not interested in you. You know, you're just a lowly minder. One day before the city fell, he just took off. His fear was... And the reason is regime change, because there'd been such little explanation to Iraqis of what it meant. They just saw the images on Al Jazeera from Guantanamo Bay and thought, if you stand up against America, that's what happens to you. You'll be ripped from the bosom of your family and be put on a plane and taken there. So it's a very difficult process now. It's a very important one. A lot has been got right. Much remains that could go wrong.
Any question right here?
There doesn't seem to be a lot of information either in the newspapers or television. And you mentioned, John Burnett, the number of civilians killed. Can you give any idea, approximate, how many Iraqi civilians have been killed in this entire war?
There's a very imprecise count that's going on. And when I left, they were saying perhaps 2,000 to 2,500. And that was a week after Baghdad had fallen. And I haven't looked at the website.
It is obviously very difficult to know. There is a website where you can look, Iraqi body count, where they piece together every tiny report and come up with their own number. Somewhere in the thousands, and what number of thousands is hard to define.
Yeah, it seems like the government, the U.S. government, doesn't want to talk about that. That's sort of...
If you ask them, they will say, we don't do body counts of civilians or of Iraqi military.
More questions? Please come to the mic.
Yes, please, ma'am. I would like to hear from each one of you, knowing what you know now about the way things are going, what you would recommend, what the United States and Britain should do to try to make the best out of the situation now. Do you have any ideas about that?
I'll put it to each of you, Michael. The solution, please.
Well, you know, Howard Dean called me the other day and asked me the same thing.
And you know George Bush, Michael. Remember George, that. Balance.
The press is not going to call me. It is incredibly complex, and it's clear that the U.S. embarked on this war without giving any real thought to what to do afterwards. And they did believe Richard Pearl and Ahmed Chalabi, and that was insane. Everything I say now is based on total speculation. There's been one single attempt at public opinion research in Iraq. It's by a company in Britain called YouGov, and it's interesting. About 50% of the Iraqi people want a commitment from the U.S. to stay for a long period of time. And I know that politically here, that's difficult. It's very clear that what's needed is a sense that the situation is not going to change, that Saddam is not coming back. And then people can start to work these things out. I think the U.S. has to clearly commit itself to being there for 2 to 3 years. The Bush administration needs to apologize and apologize thoroughly and diplomatically to the rest of the international community so that it can have, one, financial resources and, more importantly, material and men to go in and at least provide the sense of stability. I honestly think that the Iraqis are capable of organizing a confederated state despite the long history and the fact that, you know, it's a construct that came out of the Versailles Conference and was invented by Britain to make sure it had an oil supply.
Our time is so short, but John and then Raghi, the fundamentals of a resolution here.
I have no profound solution either, except that it was breathtaking, the lack of preparation, the lack of Arabic speakers, the lack of anticipating the looting of the infrastructure that has made it so difficult to get the lights back on and the oil flowing and the water going again. Was it Thomas Friedman said it was the Pottery Barn school of foreign policy? You break it, you bought it, we own it. And it absolutely will fall into even more anarchy were we to leave now. And I think the United States is doing, you know, pretty much what you have to, try to get more foreign troops in there, try to get more civil affairs people in. It was astonishing to me that I just read a little piece in the New York Times. They've decided not to close the civil affairs school for the U.S. Army. They had planned on closing it. I mean, civil affairs is kind of the way that, you know, we're having to win the peace now.
Raghi Omar, in brief, what's it going to take?
I think surely some sense of an internationalization, certainly through the United Nations route, must be considered, simply because it is a reality that the transitional process, as long as it is seen by Iraqis as an Anglo-American project with, you know, made in Washington and London stamped right across his forehead, is not the basis in which to, A, lay to ghost the conspiracy theories, quite frankly, that Iraqis have about, well, you know, George W. Bush's father, you know, he asked us to rise up in 91. We did. Thousands of people were killed. And now we're being liberated again. What's the bottom line? I mean, there is a lot of that. And I think anyone who goes there will tell you that. And in order to get over that, surely some kind of United Nations involvement, A, in the humanitarian and reconstruction fields, and also politically, to say that this is a problem for the whole world, and to give that sort of space of calm that Iraq needs. I think some form of internationalization is critical.
Michael Goldfarb, John Burnett, Raghi Omar, I want to thank each of you for being here tonight and for all of your work in Iraq. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a special edition of On Point from the Old Wailing Church in Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. For more information, go to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT.